often they couldn't afford to rebuild. And so what it does is it kind of naturalizes a process. You're like, oh, everything's left up to the market. This is natural. But what it does is it hides how the state is subsidizing this process in all sorts of ways, you know, because home ownership is subsidized by the state, all the infrastructure is subsidized by the state, all the cleanup emergency services, those are all state activities. And yet, so it's structured in such a way that the private developers can come in and profit from those state activities, but it's presented as, oh, this is a natural private phenomena.
So are there other solutions on the table that might provide a more egalitarian solution to disasters like this?
Well, you know, there was Occupy Sandy, and I'm one of a number of people who have been critical of this effort. I think initially what the activists did was great, was incredible in terms of stepping into the breach where the state was not. But really, after the first week or two, what it started to become was basically, activists were taking on the role of the state, whereas there is no way you're going to have the capacity to do this. And then it also leads to many questionable decisions in a number of instances. What winds up happening is you have these activists who are basically working for free, spending hundreds if not thousands of hours rehabbing private property, right? It's like this is not something that's in the social interest. Then you're also dealing with traumatized communities. One of the arguments has been is like, oh, we're kind of seeding new political movements and showing people, you know, how Occupy Wall Street can act in an effective way in building these links to communities. But you're dealing with, you know, people who may have lost loved ones. They certainly lost their homes or the places of residence, or they were abandoned in the dark without electricity for weeks. A lot of people got sick as a result, and a lot of the volunteers have also been getting sick because they're going into these buildings. I've been out to the Rockaways a number of times, and even 3 months later, it was toxic. Just the smell of it was toxic. I couldn't stand to be in the buildings where people were working, and I've been hearing reports from activists that people are coming down ill who've been working in these buildings. So it's just a question of like, what is the point of all this? It almost becomes this type of fetish and obsession just to do activism for the sake of activism rather than thinking about what really needs to happen. And I've talked to some ecological experts, one person, Oren Pilkney, who's one of the leading beach experts in the country, who he's basically like, look, the Rockaways needs to be returned to its natural function as a barrier island, especially as the waters continue to rise over this century, that we're going to need these barrier islands to protect the rest of the population. They shouldn't be developed at all.
Well, as the Occupy movement is really a grassroots movement, are there more effective ways people can push a more egalitarian agenda?
Well, I mean, this is something that is, of course, very difficult, that you can't do it without, you can't just conjure it out of thin air. Because really what's gone on in New York City under Bloomberg over the last 15 years is there's been massive waterfront development. And essentially, New York used to be, even in the mid-20th century, one of the most active port cities in the world. Then as part of deindustrialization, that all disappeared. There was all this vacant land. And so it was developed upon. And so what that was a massive subsidy because this was publicly owned land that was then transferred to private developers. So now there's all these talks about spending billions on storm surge barriers. And what it is it's presented, oh, it's to protect the public. But what it's really going to do is protect the developers who build all these condos and corporate towers on this land. So we need something different. But the problem is there's so much wealth behind us. This effort to protect the developers at public expense, you can't fight it without having a strong grassroots movement in place already.
Well, we have about 30 seconds left. On this one-year anniversary of Superstorm Sandy, what else would you want to add?
Well, I think the thing is, what we need is more essentially public housing. We need more public development, that these questions cannot be left into the private sphere. There are a group of architects who I talked to in New York City who came up with these very innovative and radical design ideas for how to reclaim the waterfront, how to build public housing that kind of melds with the water, kind of these floating towers to build artificial barriers. And it was a much more interesting solution, but it would require mobilizing the government and public resources towards public planning. And that's what we really need to see, is a democratized planning rather than a market-driven planning.
Great. Thank you so much. I've been speaking with Arun Gupta, who is co-founder of the Occupy Wall Street Journal and a founding editor of the NYC newspaper, The Independent. Arun, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
For KBOO FM, this is Aaron J. Bernard.
You are listening to KBOO 90.7 FM Portland. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant firm, Radio Cab, serving the metro area since 1946 with service 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. Radio Cab offers airport service, wheelchair accessible vans, and can be reached at 503-227-1212 in Vancouver at 360-694-1234 or radiocab.net.
It's about time.
13, 12, 11, 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Welcome to Occupy Portland Radio. This is Jimmy Tardy. With all due respect to Mr. Gupta, we are going to put forth the proposition today that, yes, you can conjure egalitarian activism out of thin air. Today we're going to hear from Max Kaiser, Stacey Herbert, John Ashton, Oingo Boingo, Russell Brand, John Hagelin, quantum physicist. We'll hear from Billie Holiday and the Dalai Lama, Dwight Eisenhower, Lyndon Johnson, and others from the movie Atomic Cafe make their appearances. John Perkins, author of Confessions of an Economic Hitman, sampled from Talking Stick TV. We'll hear from The Wizard of Oz, Buffalo Springfield, Jim Al-Khalili on quantum mechanics, our friend of the show from the Portland and the camping band Vigil at City Hall, Ivan Henry, and Pink Floyd. This is Occupy Portland Radio's Interference Pattern.
There's something happening here, but what it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there, telling me I got to beware. I think it's time we stop. Children, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. There's battle lines being drawn. Nobody's right if everybody's wrong. Young people speak in their minds are getting so much resistance from behind. Time we stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. What a field day for the heat. 1,000 people in the street, singing songs and carrying signs. Mostly say hooray for our side. It's time we stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. Strikes deep into your life, it will creep. It starts when you're always afraid. Step out of line, the man come and take you away. We better stop.
city. What's that sound? Everybody look what's going on. You better stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going on. You better stop now. What's that sound? Everybody look what's going on.
We now examine a phenomenon which is absolutely impossible to explain in any classical way, and which is at the very heart of quantum mechanics. The famous double slit experiment.
I'm going to explain to you what's known as the central mystery of quantum mechanics. It was Richard Feynman, the American physicist, said, this is the central mystery of quantum mechanics. There's lots of weird stuff that goes on in the quantum world. Hit you with this, and it basically tells you what it's all about. It's called the two-slit experiment. I'll start with this. Imagine you have a source of light shining against a screen with two slits, monochromatic light, light of a particular wavelength, whereas, of course, a light bulb is white light, and that's made up of all the colors of the spectrum, lots of different wavelengths. But imagine this is just a single wavelength of light, and you can see the light is coming out in waves like ripples in a pond. That's the nature of wave-like behavior. As the light hits the screen, it squeezes through the two slits, and each slit in turn on the other side becomes almost like a new source of light, and the light spreads out, it diffracts. And as the waves of light overlap, they will interfere with each other. So where a crest hits a trough, they will cancel. Where a crest hits a crest, they will amplify, and so on. And so on the back screen, you end up with what's called an interference pattern, a series of light and dark fringes, where the waves have either cancelled out or worked together in phase. That's fine. That's not quantum mechanics. That's a property of light that goes back over 200 years. That we've known about since the early 19th century. Imagine doing the same experiment again, but doing it not with waves, but with particles. Do it with grains of sand. So this is the same experiment, but I've tipped it 90 degrees. Rather than waves that are spread out, that wash up against the two slits and squeeze through, here you've got individual particles of sand, and each particle will either go through one slit or the other. And so you see they will sort of drain through, and you get two bumps underneath each of the slits. So the two peaks is reminiscent of particle-like behavior, whereas the multiple pattern of interference is wave-like behavior. What if we do the same experiment with atoms? Well, so imagine we have an atom gun, something can fire a stream of atoms. You can't see them because they're very small. Let's block off one of the two slits. So these two slits are the dimensions and separation of the slits is chosen appropriately to show us how atoms do things. And so far, so good. Nothing strange here. You'll see a lot of atoms hitting the back screen. So this will now have to be some sort of photosensitive screen whereby when an atom hits it, it'll give off a little flash of light to say the atom has arrived here. So the atoms are arriving as these little pinpricks of light that we see. Of course, a lot of the atoms will be blocked by the first screen. They won't go through that slit. But those that do get through to the other side, you can see there's a bit of spreading of the atoms. But if we didn't know anything about atoms, you'd say, well, that's fine. We can understand that. But a lot of the atoms are going clean through the slit. Some are sort of maybe bouncing off the edge of the slit, and so they're sort of being deflected a bit, which is why you get a bit of a spread. The first mystery of quantum mechanics comes when we open the second slit. Because now we see something that's very much like the interference pattern we got with light. Rather than having two bands of spots where the atoms have gone through the two slits, it's as though the atoms have gone through the slits behaving like waves, and you get interference of the waves and you get these bands. If we know nothing about atoms or quantum mechanics, you could try and rationalize it and say, well, maybe atoms behave in a very strange way and only a certain number of them are allowed to all sit together. And so, me and my gang, we're all going to go on this slit. No, sorry, no room for you. You go to the next slit above. And by the way, there's this rule that no one can go in between the two bands, but a few naughty atoms do. So there's a bit of a scatter. There could be some forces between atoms that make them coordinate their actions in a way to give this pattern. That's not mysterious. That's just, we just don't know how atoms do things. But we can be clever, and we can force the issue. What if we were to not send the atoms all through at once, but send them through one at a time? As I say, some atoms will hit the first screen and not get through, but those that get through will hit the back screen. So let's run the experiment again slowly, and gradually you'll see as the atoms go through, they'll be look like they're just randomly arriving on the other side. You keep sending atoms through one at a time, and gradually that same pattern appears. So each atom by itself is somehow contributing its small part to the overall wave-like behavior that we see in the interference pattern. How does it do it? How does... We know the atom's a tiny, localized particle. We can't see it. It's too small to even see under a microscope. We're firing it at the screen with the two slits. Some moment later, you see a flash of light on the back screen. It's arrived in a localized point. It's not spread itself out. You don't get sort of like a wash of a sort of a faint light across the whole screen. It's a little point. The atom is localized. It's arrived in a certain location. And yet, it somehow seems to have been aware of there being two slits, not one, because it's given rise to this interference pattern. How does one atom do that? Does it split in half? Does it become like a cloud that goes through both? Well, we can try and be even cleverer. What if we were to spy on the atom and see where it goes? We can just gently just observe which slit it goes through. So you put a detector just above the upper slit that will flash or beep whenever it sees an atom go through that top slit. Sure enough, you fire the atoms through one at a time. 50% of the time, the detector will beep. The other 50% of the time, it doesn't, the assumption being that the atom has gone through the lower slit. But of course, I've been cheeky here. I haven't shown you the results of the experiment. 50% of the time, it beeps and you see a spot arrive adjacent to the upper slit. The other half of the time, it doesn't beep, but you see a spot arrive at the lower slit. So, yeah, it's picked out the atoms that have gone through the upper slit and not the ones that have gone through. So each atom does go through one slit or the other. But that's a different result to what we had earlier. So here's the last bit of sneakiness that we can play with atoms. Surely now, you know, we're going to get to grips with it. Leave the detector there, but just very quietly go and unplug it. Don't let the atoms know that you're not spying on them. Make them think that you're still detecting them. So, yeah, okay, we're going to run the experiment. Atoms, okay, get ready, one at a time. We're going to be checking on you. All right, so run the experiment again. That's what you get, this interference pattern. Now, if you can explain this using common sense and logic, do let me know. Because there's a Nobel Prize for you.
Amazing array of spontaneous rainbows creating radiant radial planes, a vivid divination bursting, rehearsing, and thirsting to alleviate frustrations. My occupation during times of complication is lacing with perfect unification and rejuvenating all who stand tall, feeling true purification, conscious awakening, operating under the constellations. So stop waiting, it's time to find your inspiration. Abounding enlightenment, profound and brightening environment, with fear defiance and spirit science is the requirements. Worthy alliance, and clearly the sphere is alive with vibrance, evergreen revivance, imbibing all with radiant liveness. Just to recite this illustrious and of the light, it's delightful, igniting heart spark imparting insight. From sunshine to starry night, sharpening sight, all are invited to ignite spark and hearken flight. Admiring, inspiring, and retiring, and lying, enterprising, enlightened, exciting cycles, reviving, providing, coinciding, enlivening into timing, designing benign with elaborate fashion, and actualizing, tantalizing appetite for magic, arising and thriving, a very fine thing, exquisitely vivid, divining, one more time, delivered and given from the mind, fulfilling ancient conjecture, distilling nectar in a rhyme. Emblazoned with the sacred arrangement between heaven and earth, a clever remembered the purity we resemble from birth. They tremble at awakened potential when it's shaken. The worst essential message presented in elements laid in a verse. Tremendous consciousness squashing nonsense through the optics of dirt. What it's worth, we are all evolving and sharing and solving and caring. Solutions are always there, though they may be daring. Glaring light will shine through. May it quickly find you with giving and living an infinite light of divine truth. And when you realize that you've been buying lies at a design they contrive to hide from you. Like a true sunrise, you'll open your eyes and you'll find what is right for you. Critical mass is now visibly past the ability of industry to hide behind a villain mask. It's real in the past, history's vast, and most of the mysteries clearing, and with synergy growing and glowing brilliantly, showing vivid virility, gaining skill and agility, truly living lucidity, duly giving fluidity to the notion of devotion to open creativity. And when you free your mind, you will find the time to rewind to a life that's true, free of all binding slave designs, and you find that the light is you. We are all born with facilities and adorned with abilities, even to cure every disability, literally being inner tranquility, blessed sensibility, psychic fertility and generosity still in me, virility diligently bringing visions of chivalry, indubitably true, and with the pureness of Buddha we see insightful, delightful holographic matrix awakening the purely positive energy every new day that it brings.
Corruption.
Extortion.
Deforestation.
Global warming.
Human trafficking.
Money laundering.
Corruption.
Extortion.
Deforestation.
Global warming.
Human trafficking.
Money laundering.
Corruption.
Extortion.
Deforestation.
Global warming.
Human trafficking.
Money laundering.
The system itself inherently encourages that kind of behavior. When looking for the culprits and who to prosecute after these transgressions, look for the people that after that crash, where loads of ordinary people lost loads and loads of money, look for the people that have got loads of bonuses and loads of money. They're the people that are criminal. Those are the people that need to be prosecuted. And whilst to a degree we have to placate the city because our economy is built on it, don't you think it's happened a bit too much that they can behave in this rampaging manner while ordinary people continue to suffer? I think that we need to see punitive measures immediately employed so that it doesn't continue to recur, not just because of some weird lefty agenda, but because if there are not penalties, the behaviour will happen cyclically. So people need to go down, and it's the people that have got the money that need to go down.
We are talking today with John Perkins. He is author of the new book, Confessions of an Economic Hitman. John, thank you for spending time with us today.
It's great to be here, Mike. Thank you for having me.
Start out and tell us, what was the motivation in writing your book, Confessions of an Economic Hitman?
9/11 was the motivation. I'd put off writing this book for a long time. I was sworn to secrecy. I'd been bribed not to write it. I'd been threatened when I tried to write it earlier. And I'd postponed it. I'd put off writing it until 9/11. And when 9/11 happened, I knew this story had to be told. It has to get out there. Most of the American people are totally unaware of what really goes on with our foreign policy, of what our banks and corporations are doing around the world, of the way we're building empire, and of the way we're irritating people. We're creating. Most Americans don't understand that. If we understood it, if we understood the way the world feels about us, I think we would change. We're a very compassionate people, and we would make that change. People need to know what we're doing, and then we can create change. We have a tremendous opportunity here to move into a new world, and for America to be a leader in creating a feeling of compassion and a republic, a true democracy and a true republic around the world that begins to attack some of the serious, serious problems that humanity is facing. Economic hitmen work through private corporations, not directly for the government. That keeps everything much more secret, and it leaves the government out. The government cannot be implicated as long as this is being done through private consultants. The consulting firms, of course, are paid by the U.S. government as consulting firms, and people like me, then my salary was paid by this consulting firm. But it was very clear, it was very obvious to me what I was supposed to do, and after I agreed to join this effort, I was then trained by an amazing woman who's described in detail in Confessions of an Economic Hitman. Her name is Claudine, and she was very beautiful, very seductive, extremely talented, knew exactly what to do, knew all the hooks, knew all my weaknesses, and brought me in. You know, I like to think of myself as a good person at heart, and I grew up in a family in New Hampshire that came from over 300 years of Yankee Calvinists. We have very strong moral values, very principled, and I think I'm a really good case in point of how the system can seduce you, how there's three very powerful drugs in our lives these days, sex, money, and power, and I was seduced by all three of those. these guys would come back from their vacations with these amazing stories to tell, you know, the debutante balls they'd been to and the orgies. And you know, my life was so boring. And I developed this complex that I really wanted to excel and I wanted to live that kind of a life. And then I went to Middlebury College, and much of the same there, that there were a lot of wealthy people at Middlebury. In all of these organizations, there are a few people who are the economic hitmen, who know what's going on, and the rest are pretty much kept in the dark, and they're doing their jobs, what they see as their job. We had a whole system in place of convincing everybody that what they were doing was right, and then rewarding them, or the carrot and stick approach, that they get well rewarded when they did what I wanted, and if they didn't do it, they didn't get rewarded, and they might get fired. So they didn't have the same benefit that I did of being told, this is what you're doing. And in the end, that made me feel very guilty that I'd manipulated people like that. It was one of the reasons that I wanted to get out, and one of the reasons that I wrote the book, because that's typical. Throughout these organizations, there are people doing that. Throughout the corporate world, I know people who work for big corporations now that are outsourcing, that have sweatshops in Asia, producing the goods that they're selling in the United States, paying people a dollar a day or less, people who are working in terrible conditions. And the men and women who are in charge of those operations out of places like Seattle and Portland and San Francisco and various other places, these men and women are going into these countries. They know, in their hearts, they know that what they're doing isn't right. But back home in the headquarters office is a whole team of psychologists, lawyers, and others telling them that what they're doing is fine, it's good, and that the people who are working in the sweatshops getting a dollar a day are better off than as if they didn't have those jobs, which is patently absurd, because those people, many of them lived on subsistence economies. True, they may never have made any money before, but they lived very well on subsistence economies until these companies came in and created a local market, a local economy that now depends on the dollar. So in a very few years, they've gone from living subsistence lives and statistically having no money at all, totally impoverished statistically, but their lives are quite good, to now suddenly having to work for these big corporations, working in these sweatshops, making a dollar a day, dependent on the dollar economy, or maybe it's $10 a day, whatever, but dependent on that money, and the subsistence existence they had before is gone. And then that company, the next year, decides that the labor pool is cheaper someplace else, and they move out. And these people who become dependent on these pittances they've been paid by our companies suddenly don't have even the pittance. And it's a terribly tragic situation. And the men and women who are the equivalent of the corporate economic hit people who are doing this, I know them. I know a number of them personally. In their hearts, they know what they're doing is wrong, but they're being well rewarded. Their families are being taken care of. Someone's patting them on the back saying, isn't it wonderful that you're making it possible for these people to get a dollar a day? And they have a whole team, as I said before, psychologists, economists, and lawyers telling them that everything they do is perfectly good and for the best and for the best of the world. That's how we build empire. The laws are written to protect this system, to protect what I call the corporatocracy, the big business, big banks, and government people who are running this empire. Of course, it doesn't surprise me in the least bit, but it's a very, very corrupt system, and corruption can be done in extremely subtle ways.
Thank you. blood on the leaves and blood at the root. Black bodies swinging in the southern breeze. Strange fruit hanging from the poplar trees. The sudden smell of burning flesh. Here is a fruit for the crows to pluck, for the rain to gather, for the wind to suck, for the sun to rot, for the tree.
Social crisis and tension, in times when changes come so thick and fast that the individual can no longer place himself in his group, when he knows that something is wrong but doesn't know what, when he feels himself a pawn, in times like these, most men become highly suggestible. They listen eagerly for any voice which sounds authoritative. They listen eagerly for anyone who can tell them what is wrong and what to do to right it, who can diagnose their trouble and prescribe a cure.
Eisenhower, man of the hour.
I don't mean to say, and no one can say to you, that there are no dangers. Of course there are risks if we are not vigilant. But we do not have to be hysterical. We can be vigilant, we can stand up and hold up our heads and say, it is up to us to lead this world to a peaceful and secure existence. And I assure you, we can do it.
We must learn to live in a world where we can destroy any city.
What seems to be the trouble, soldier? You look a little bit worried.
Well, I am, Chaplain. Just a little bit.
Actually, there's no need to be worried, as the Army has taken all of the necessary precautions to see that we're perfectly safe here.
Sir, have you ever been out at one of these shots before?
Yes, I've had the opportunity to see a number of the atomic tests. I feel that as a chaplain, it is my responsibility to be with my men.
What's it like, Chaplain?
First of all, one sees a very, very bright light, followed by a shock wave, and then you hear the sound of the blast, and then it seems as though there's a minor earthquake. And then you look up and you see the fireball as it ascends up into the heaven. It's a wonderful sight to behold.
Good opportunity. As a practitioner, as a Buddhist, my daily prayer, right from the beginning, early morning, these days, about 3:30, I wake up. Then immediately, I set up my mind. Rest of the day, my body, speech, mind, dedicate to well-being of others. Well, that, so, then more difficulties, more heavier responsibility, have this adversity, feel, oh, this is a good opportunity to serve something. Like that, as I mentioned earlier, when we face some problem, and due to impatience, and due to short-sighted, or due to narrow-minded, then frustrations, anger. When we face problem, look wide away, long term, it brings more determination, more willpower. Like that. Whether sensible or not, I practice that way. Next question.
Please welcome, well, let's hold on, there's some facts here on teleprompter, right? He's a world-renowned, Harvard-trained quantum physicist. We ain't just got some quantum physicist off the street. This one's renowned. You go to Sri Lanka and say, name a quantum physicist, they'll go, oh, John Hagelin, he's good, isn't he? Harvard, proper good school, that, out of the Facebook film. Brilliant. Imagine that. So, after this bit of me finishes in a minute, a new bit of life will begin where I talk to a quantum physicist, although he might tell us that that has already happened due to the baffling nature of quantum physics. Please welcome to the stage a man who can answer all those questions and more and probably give us new questions which we've already got the answers to, and the very paradigm of interrogative nature can be unravelled like a wormhole. Please welcome John Hagelin. John, which chair would you prefer to sit in, or do you believe in a parallel universe we're sitting in both of them anyway?
Two simultaneously, but give me the north.
Good, as long as you're happy. John, I do have genuine questions of a quantum physicist.
You talk funny.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. What you just said then was a hate crime against the English. You've learned nothing from the night's proceedings. Come straight out and done a hate crime. John, why on earth are you, a quantum physicist, even here on a night where we're talking about transcendental meditation?
That should be obvious. Quantum physics has basically revealed the fundamental unity of life. Surface diversity, but deeper levels at the molecular, atomic, subatomic, subnuclear, electroweak unified, etc., culminates in the discovery of what's called the unified field, fulfilling Einstein's dream of revealing the fundamental unity at the basis of the diversity of the universe. Now, what does that have to do with us?
How dare you say I talk funny and then come out with that? So you're saying that the idea that things are separate and distinct from each other on a material level is illusory. Is
sensory
that what you're saying?
Illusion. That's correct.
It's a sensory illusion.
That's correct. But you can go beyond the senses. And that's what meditation traditionally is. Properly understood, it is a technique to pull the awareness from the outwardly directed senses powerfully within to experience deeper levels of mind, simpler, quieter, more unified levels of the thinking process, and then slipping beyond thought, that's where the transcendental comes in, beyond thought altogether to experience this universal unity at the basis of mind and matter.
So we can access neurologically in our own minds the unifying field of creativity from which all energy and matter has come, perhaps even the cosmos and universe itself. Is that what you're saying?
That's right. And it's not just philosophically interesting, but it's really practically important, because that meditative state is considered to be a fourth state of consciousness. That means not waking, dreaming, sleeping, in which the entire brain, as we've heard, is engaged. And that orderly, coherent style of functioning of the brain develops the full potential of human life. So truth be told, meditation, transcendental meditation, comes from the ancient wisdom of yoga, and it's designed, it's engineered to develop the full potential of the brain. And as a side benefit, stress, stress-related illness melts away.
John, do you reckon if through meditation we can achieve access to a fuller state of consciousness, it may help us to bring about a global revolution where we found a society based on spiritual principles rather than material and economic ones?
It's the only way. Because
yes, I thought there'd be a revolution tonight. I'm right in the mood.
A society based on utilizing 5% of the innate potential of the brain is going to be more or less like the society we have.
Yeah, idiots. We're like monkeys. But we're just like stupid monkeys. But if we utilize more of mine, we'll become more sophisticated. We'll build a utopia, a blissful utopia.
Smarter monkeys, yeah.
We'll still be sort of monkeys.
At least of an evening in front of the laptop. Right, kids?
If the fundamental reality of life is unity, if we are all one at our core but don't see it, that bringing that unity from within to the surface of perception and understanding, that is a transformed world. That is a unified world. That is a peaceful world.
That's
and
important.
A side effect of what we're doing.
So, I see. So through this, we can achieve awareness of the unity that exists between all of us, that we are unity. Distinction, nation, religion, creed, these are all illusions. We're building our lives around illusion. If we know something to be true, then we should build our culture, our societies, our faiths, our institutions around that truth, and unity will be an inevitable consequence of that.
I think you deserve to be married to Katy Perry.
It's worked out. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
It made the years of drug addiction worthwhile.
And thank... I'm so glad, and I hope my son can follow in your footsteps. And I just want to thank everybody.
He's going to have to. I'm taking him home as a butler.
Thanks.
I've always
to all
wanted
of you.
A quantum physicist butler. Yeah. You rang, my lord? Actually, not yet.
It probably pays better than being a quantum physicist. Anyway, I want to thank so much all of you who've helped us bring TM to 500,000 kids in the last few years. At-risk children.
And yeah, well done.
And millions in the years to come. God bless you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, John Hagelin. And later on, I want to ask you questions how electrons can exist simultaneously, what neutrinos are. There's loads of questions I need to know the answers to help me to do this revolution. You get back here and give me a cuddle.
All right. Dessert chatter. Neutrinos.
Thanks, John.
From my heart and from my hand, why don't people understand my intention? Understand my intentions.
It's prolific when I spit, it's the realest and it's terrific. We combine the scientific with ritual spiritualistic. A cynical perspective like a heroin derivative. Polluted and fake and undisputed disgrace. You get a taste of vivid visions, change the look on your face. With ancient creative light of love, may fellow humans be laced. Ornately divine, peace of mind, be your natural pleasure. Actual fate, solely controlled by your inner state. True inspiration lets me and you see past the ego face. And real elation reveals complications troubling our race with blessed illumination. Let your fascination create as evolution continues to help create solutions and institutions dissolve involved in human persecution and perfect union, spreading effervescence and blessing and blooming, looming in every breath that's spoken and healing the broken ocean of pure awareness, curing the air, surely provoking genetic memories evoking, farm of love stoking, ever mending medicine prevalent and strong as the oak and spirit is living through giving, sacred and gifted with vision, blossoming intuition, also meant in position, honoring traditions and coming unto the one fruition, elegantly demonstrated evidence of omnipresence, sentence for sentence, relentlessly cleansing the elements, delivered in through rivers of consciousness, and building with common sense and ultimate confidence. It's obvious, knowledge immense, tolerant, loving intent is systematically activating wisdom indefinite, gorgeous euphoric connection, fractal comprehension with actual dimensions too lengthy for IBM's inventions, Ouroboros deeply set in memories from ancestors, doorways open in consciousness and nerve receptors, organic fortunate beings of light, guided in direction, seizing over the planet, inhabitants loving, professing stories of ancient origin, orally shared through vibration, scintillating, initiating, collapse of limitations, processing forwards, backwards through space and time and chapters, and to be us the truest beauties who were modeled after. A lot of the data collection in the millennium of the goddess from modern prophets prepares options to then come. Welcome, sisters and brother in home, and then drum. Align your ideals with spirit. For healing and men dumb, second to none. The all-encompassing field of unity, you and me, infinity, and all you see held in a seed.
Climate change is an existential threat. We know how to fix it. We actually claim that we're fixing it, but we're not fixing it really. And if we want it fixed, it is okay to be a little bit angry. But anger at the same time really isn't enough. And it's not enough because, as I said, this is a transformational process, and the system that we're trying to transform is the energy system. The energy system is at the heart of the economy, so we're trying to transform the economy, and at the heart of the economy is a whole set of power relationships that are embedded in the economy. And that system actually has some quite good antibodies for resisting change. It's got a lot of inertia built into it, and on the whole, that's a good thing. It's an excellent thing if you're not facing an existential threat. It's an excellent thing if institutions are working well and trusted by people to act in their interest. And it's an excellent thing if your politics is working. But the trouble is, none of those conditions apply at the moment. Now, I imagine here in this rather well-appointed secondary school, there aren't many die-hard Leninists. I wonder, can anybody who's a die-hard Leninist please put their hands up? I think the headmaster's gone. I won't tell him I can't see a single diehard Leninist. Lenin wrote a famous pamphlet, which was called What is to be Done? And that pamphlet was about how to channel anger into effective political action. And actually, that's the right question. I'm not about to kind of offer you a Leninist prospectus, but the question is right. And it's a hard question, not an easy one. And I have been in this business for 15 years. I really don't know what the answer is, except I do know that you and the generation that you represent, people who are under 30 today, you are a really important part of the answer to that question. Because you've got more of your future ahead of you, because you're not, as it were, complicit in the way that we've been running our societies, our economies so far. And above all, because, and I don't know what, this is a place where many of you, I'm sure, are very politically educated and politically engaged, but I can tell you that as a whole, in Britain, in Europe, in North America, in large parts of East Asia, your generation has rather turned its back on politics. You've rather drawn the conclusion that politics isn't addressing the questions that are going to matter to you. So you've, as it were, gone into a kind of self-imposed exile from the mainstream. You've left the public square, if you like. And really my core proposition tonight is, if you want to fix the climate, if you want to fix climate politics, then actually you've got to fix politics. Climate politics comes out of politics as a whole. And politics isn't right at the moment. You've heard that elsewhere tonight. And if you want to fix politics, you have to bring in some new voices. Don't rely on the established voices, because they will give you established solutions which are not solutions. And the most powerful new voice that can be brought into the picture, brought into the public square, is yours. So if we want to fix this problem of climate change, your voice is critical, and your voice can actually bring a new jolt of electricity into politics. I can't tell you how to use your voice. I have no permission, no author. I'm 56 years old. I can't tell people who are under 30 how to use. All I can do is encourage. I can share, and my generation can share, the experiences that we have from the corridors of power, from the boardroom, from the negotiating chamber. And we can at least all make our experiences available. But the leadership, the ideas, the mobilization, if they don't come from your generation, they won't come at all. But with that health warning, I can at least offer perhaps a couple of suggestions. The first one is, don't turn away from politics. Turn back to politics. Engage with it, but do that in a way which is purposeful, which is strategic, which is organized on the basis that you as a generation have together, a conversation that you have together about the kind of future that you want to experience. The second suggestion is this. You've all heard of the Occupy movement. Maybe some of you were camped outside St. Paul's Cathedral in Paternoster Square. I don't know. But the Occupy movement was pretty significant, I think. Historians will look back and say it was significant, but not for what it was and what it is. It was significant for where it points to, the next stage. And that's my second suggestion. It's this. Don't occupy, or at least don't just occupy, vacant spaces, public squares, empty buildings. Take your place in crowded spaces and make your voice heard in those spaces. Join political parties, but join them on your own terms. Join government departments, join companies, NGOs, faith groups, local authorities, but join them on your own terms, and do it in a purposeful, strategic, organized way based on a conversation that you're having with each other about the kind of future you want to build. And don't let anybody say to you, you have no right to make your voice heard. You have no authority to do that. Seems to me that anybody who says that, it's like saying in the US to Gabrielle Giffords, the congresswoman who was shot tragically, it's like saying to her that she has no right to express a view on gun control, which is what the National Rifle Association, I think, did say to her, absurdly. Third suggestion, don't let the question, as you join all of those crowded rooms, enter those crowded rooms, don't let the question be, what can we do to avoid too much change? Demand that the question be, who can we be to make possible the changes that we need, so that our future becomes as attractive as the future looked when you were our age, when people like me were your age? Because I think there's no more salient political fact in the world today than the fact that in many societies, your generation is looking at the future and saying, actually, it's not as attractive as it looked to our parents when they were our age. That's an extraordinary thing. There are really two attitudes anybody can have towards the future. You can see the future as something that's going to happen to you. You can kind of lay back and let it flow over you, but if what happens to you isn't what you like, don't then blame anybody for how it turned out. Or you can say the future is going to be what we build. You're going to get, each one of you, the inheritance that my generation leaves you. And you can wait for it. You can sit back and let it happen to you, and you'll get what you get. Or you can say, I want my inheritance now, or at least I want to claim my part in shaping that inheritance. If my parents could do that in a war-ravaged Britain of the 1950s, then you can do that, we can do it together, in a much wealthier Britain and a much wealthier world, actually, of the 2010s and beyond. Thank you very much.
Yes, and neither would you, Derek, the star nonsense.
Yes, yes.
No, it is it.
I'm sure of it.
Thank you.
The time is 7 o'clock straight up. Stay tuned for Hard Knock Radio. And you are listening to KBOO 90.7 FM Portland, and also heard around the web at www.kbu.fm. Stay tuned after these messages.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the Cascadia Psychedelic Revival Halloween Meltdown. Thursday, October 31st, 8 till 2:30 a.m., five bands with psychedelic 60s and 70s influences will play the Meltdown at the Bob White Theater in Portland. The bands featured are The Real, Cody and the Wheel, The Kingpins, Coca-Bola, and Mugspoon. They will be performing with the Vintage Oil Slides Psychedelic Light Show by Liquid Lights, Steve Goldsmith, and the Psychedelic Express. That's the Cascadia Psychedelic Revival Halloween